Welcome to Artrageous, a weekly podcast about the truly outrageous stories in the art and design world. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Artrageous. I really hope that you guys enjoyed our story time for the past couple of weeks as we talked about the Scream heist in 1994 and 2004. I know I did, except for the little recording audio issues last week, which I definitely could have done without. Hopefully, I'm a little bit luckier with the technical difficulties this week, but hey, it's a process, stuff happens, and I got the episode out there for everyone to enjoy, so I'm going to call that a win. I mean, if I'm not battling technical difficulties this week, then, you know, my voice is a little scratchy, but we're just going to power through it, because this week, I wanted to talk a little bit about something that crossed my keyboard during research for one of the other episodes. I think it might have been when I was fact-checking myself on info for the Midjourney episode when I was talking about JPEG file formats, and I had to edit myself to keep myself from nerding out more than I already did and prevent myself from going into this topic as well. Because as you guys can guess from the title, this is an entire episode in and of itself. And while this might be a shorter episode, who knows, I might get rambling, but I still wanted to take a look at the topic of vector graphics and kind of tell their history, because it's a file type that I use almost every day, and it just sounded like an interesting topic to look into. I do want to put a small disclaimer here that if you are an artist or graphic designer or someone who's pretty familiar with vector graphics, then some of what's in this episode might be more on the side of, yeah, duh, I already knew that. But I did try to balance the topics in this episode so you aren't completely bored out of your skull. On the opposite side of that coin, I also don't want to lose anyone along the way if you aren't already familiar with some of the topics in today's episode. So I promise to do my best to make it so that you can stick around and not feel like you're in over your head. So today is a balancing act, but I try to include a little bit of something for everyone. And with that noted, let's get started. The first thing I looked up for this topic was exactly what are vector graphics? And let me tell you, the internet has some answers that just go entirely over my head. Sometimes I just want a really simple answer and the search results make everything just so dang complicated. You know how some people try to sound smart, so they use really big words and technical terms to try to impress people? Well, I'll admit, I did kind of ask for it when I Googled it, but the internet definitely didn't have to make me feel that dumb on a very early Monday morning when I started looking into all of this stuff. The internet describes vector graphics as a form of computer graphics in which visual images are created directly from geometric shapes defined on a Cartesian plane, such as points, lines, curves, and shapes that are based on mathematical formulas. Okay, the Cartesian plane thing was just absolutely unnecessary, Sir Internet. But if I were going to make that as simple as possible to try to understand, vector graphics are exactly like the connect the dots things that you used to do as a little kid. You have a whole bunch of dots that are connected by lines that are either straight or curved. These dots are what we call anchor points, and the curves are created by what's called handles. An anchor point can have up to two handles that come off in any direction, and that combination of two points and handles create a curved line. A designer can then play around with the positioning of the anchor points and the length and position of the handles to create shapes that can be super, super simple or ridiculously complex. You're going to hear me probably say this multiple times throughout the episode, but really the absolute greatest benefit of creating images using this method is that because the images are made from points and lines and stuff that's based on mathematical formulas, it allows for that image to be infinitely scalable, which means that you can make it as big as you want or as small as you want without losing any quality. Regardless of the size you created the vector image at, you can literally make that same image the size of a bottle cap, or you can make it the size of a billboard, and it will still be clear and crisp, and it won't lose any resolution or look blurry. An example I'm thinking of is, you know, have you ever tried to pull an image from the internet and it's just super tiny and grainy? So you think, okay, let me pop it into Photoshop and try to make it bigger. After upscaling it using the basic tools, you're then left with something that's technically bigger, but it's even more blurry. If that image that you pulled from the internet is a JPEG or a PNG file, that means the image is a pixel-based image, or what artists call a raster image. Those types of images use colorized pixels to create the image you're seeing. With the scenario that I just described, the problem with raster images is that it's pretty easy to make them smaller, but making them bigger is a huge problem. When you make it bigger, the program you're using has to effectively make up pixels to fill in space between the existing pixels that you're moving further apart when you're stretching it out. Really, the program is kind of guessing what to fill that space with based on the existing pixels around it. And while Photoshop and some other programs have gotten better at it over the years, it's still not that great of an option if you really want a clear, crisp image. Even with making images smaller, the same thing is happening, but in reverse. If you're shrinking something down, the program has to figure out which pixels to delete to keep the image looking like what it originally was. Users generally have a bit of control over that with certain settings, but really, if you're upscaling or downscaling, there's a lot of guesswork from the computer that's happening. And heaven forbid you have to make an image smaller, but then later decide you want it bigger. Not only have you permanently deleted pixels, but now you're asking the computer to make up pixels to try to fill in what was previously deleted. It's honestly a mess and the absolute bane of my existence as a designer that works with images on a day-to-day basis. And of course, there are a few ways to try to prevent all of that stuff depending on what you're doing, but really there's absolutely nothing more frustrating than a blurry, low-quality image. So why don't we just use really big pixel images all the time for everything? Wouldn't that just solve the blurry photo issue? Well, it really comes down to data and file sizes. The more pixels you have, the bigger the file size. For something like a web page, every time you're clicking to another page, the images have to load. And I'm sure at some point we've all been to a website that's so slow to load. It's just super frustrating and makes you want to leave the site as quick as possible. So yes, speed actually does matter, especially when it comes to customer service. Fun fact, Google recommends a website page load time to be under 2 seconds, which they've defined as the threshold for e-commerce website acceptability. But as a user, you're going to notice 2 seconds, and Google knows this. So Google aims for web page load speeds to be under a half second. That might sound just okay, but really that's pretty quick if you're loading a web page filled with content and all kinds of other stuff. Looking at that e-commerce page example, these pages are often filled with all kinds of photos that show products and things for consumers to look at. In this example, there's a ton of images with a lot of data being loaded simultaneously. So how do designers keep web page load speeds under 2 seconds? The solution for these pages is to use images with only the number of pixels that are needed. So for product photos like the thumbnail images you see when browsing a web store, they're a lot smaller than the images you see when you click on a product and view it in a bigger size. It really does depend on the site, but in this imaginary example, I'm going to say maybe those thumbnail images are like a max of 250 by 300 pixels, which makes for a really small file size. Because the website is then accessing a ton of really small files that load a lot easier, it's going to shorten the total web page load time rather than the poor website servers trying to access a ton of absolutely huge files that would take forever to load individually, let alone all at once. Combine that with website traffic, where you potentially have hundreds or thousands of people loading the same thing at the same time. The website servers need to be able to support all of that activity all at once. If it can't, then that's when you're going to see things like the Coinbase website crashing when they ran their bouncing QR code commercial during the Super Bowl. What happened there was everyone was accessing the site all at once, and the servers just couldn't handle that kind of traffic, so the site just crashed, and then no one could get to it. But yeah, that's kind of a somewhat lengthy tangent explanation of pixel-based images like JPEGs and PNGs. Hopefully I didn't poo-poo on those file formats too much because they definitely do have a place in the design world. Really, the key difference between raster and vector files comes down to how that graphic is being used. Despite all the pros for vector graphics, their biggest con is that they can't do the same thing that photos do. if you take a photo with your camera, it will never be a vector image because that's just not how photos are made. Cameras collect data from light on their sensors to create a pixel-based image. They can't translate that light data into the mathematical-based points and curves that make up a vector image. So yes, designers have to use raster images when designing things using photos, especially in that e-commerce space with retail applications to show photos of products. But getting back on track here, how do vector images fit into all of that? Well, because there are clear limitations to raster pixel-based image formats like JPEGs and PNGs, luckily there's a solution. I'll get into the history stuff here in a bit, but let's quickly talk about why vector graphics. Well, I said it before, but the biggest reason comes down to scalability. There's a huge need to print art at multiple sizes. There's an even bigger, huge, giant need for responsive web design that adapts to varying screen sizes. Those two things alone make vector files an absolute necessity of modern design in this digital age. Since vectors create clean, scalable images, they allow for so many exciting visual possibilities while also having that added bonus of functionality. The biggest example I can think of in relation to responsive web design and websites adapting to various screen sizes is logos. There's nothing worse than a blurry, unreadable logo, and I think that even tops the blurry images thing. You know, not only does it make the company name and brand hard to read and recognize, but it also looks really bad on the company. Regardless of what they're trying to do or sell, and maybe this is a me thing as a designer, but if their website's logo is blurry and I can tell that their website wasn't built using the correct graphics, then it really looks bad on their part and kind of makes me doubt the company, their products, you know, anything like that. And I'll admit, maybe that's not a fair evaluation in all cases. If it's a startup or a small business that can't afford to hire a web designer or freelance designer, or if it's one person doing everything themselves, then okay, I can cut some slack. But if I ever see a blurry Google logo on a site that claims it's a Google site, then shame on them, because that is absolutely clearly a scam. Side note, if you ever get an email from a company and you're not sure if it's legit, sometimes all you have to do is look at the logo. If it's blurry or stretched weird in any way, even if it's slightly discolored, that is a telltale sign that the email you're looking at is a scam. Another sign if you do find a site is to look and see if there's any contact information or place to submit a contact us form. A lot of times these scam sites won't actually have a way for you to reach the scammers on the other end. And another one is if there's all kinds of spelling and grammatical errors on any pages, especially the terms and condition page, close that browser window immediately. I know this is a super weird tangent, but it's something I feel passionately about. It's something I know that can help people. So I'm going to say that if there's one thing that you take away from today's episode, it would be that, just as a quick lesson to help prevent getting scammed. On a happier note, let's talk about one quick fun fact before we take a commercial break. And since the Comic Sans episode is one of my highest downloaded episodes, I am happy to talk about this one. Fonts. Yes, digital fonts are actually vectors. Anything you read on an electronic device is actually a vector. That's because modern typography is almost exclusively created using vectors. That's why you can increase and decrease font sizes almost infinitely, and Comic Sans will still look like a crispy, curvy Comic Sans at any size. If you do ever happen to decrease the font size that it's so small and looks a little bit pixelated, that is a device screen resolution issue. That's not an indicator that the text is a raster graphic. So yeah, logos, fonts, certain illustrations that aren't photos, all of those things are probably better off being vector images and are so commonplace that you might be seeing vector images without even consciously realizing it. I'm going to take a quick break to recalibrate into storytelling mode, and when we come back, I will get into the history of vector graphics. So stick around because I have some stuff that's super interesting and you won't want to miss it. welcome back. As the title of the episode suggests, I am going to go back in time and dive into a little bit of the history of vector graphics. So let's get started with the question I jotted down before I even sat down to begin research for this episode. Where did vector graphics come from, and what is the history behind vector graphics? Vector files have been around for a lot longer than I would have guessed, and they also have a very surprising origin. I would have thought that maybe it would have something to do with computer graphics or video games, which I was partially right, and we'll get back to that in a bit, but vector graphic displays were first used as part of the U.S. SAGE air defense system. SAGE is short for Semi-Automatic Ground Environment, and it was the United States' first official air defense system developed during the Cold War. All right, so it looks like we're going to get a little bigger history lesson today than I originally anticipated. But to be clear, though, the beginning of this history lesson is talking about the display hardware for vector graphics. Logically thinking about the history and development of vector graphics, the display portion kind of needs to come first before people could actually see the things, let alone develop them into what they are today. If we look back to the 1950s and think about the first computers, you might think of the giant computer in the 2014 movie, The Imitation Game, where it weighed like 30 tons and took up basically the entire room. But most noticeably, it did not have a display screen. These computers couldn't display the raster images that we were talking about earlier in the episode because of the computer's very limited memory. If I think back to 2006, when I was in sixth grade, I remember having a flash drive that had a max capacity of probably 256 megabytes. Nowadays, you can get flash drives with 60 gigabytes, 100 gigabytes. Shoot, I'm sure there's even 1 terabyte flash drives out there. But that really just shows how far the memory technology has come between 2006 and 2023. So if we think back to the 1950s, when all this technology was first coming out, 256 megabytes for a flash drive, if we needed more than that, we had to have a computer that was the size of an entire room. But still, they couldn't display these raster images because their memory was that limited. And because of these limitations, vector graphics were developed as a solution because X and Y data points took up a lot less memory than raster and bitmap images. Surprisingly, it was the U.S. Department of Defense that first began using vector images for maps and interactive modeling. Looking at historical events, on September 3rd, 1949, the U.S. became aware of an atomic explosion. Even though estimates said that the Soviet Union was still about 3 years away from completing a working atomic bomb, the United States still began routine monitoring to detect atomic explosions in the Soviet Union. To make matters even worse, not only did the Soviet Union have some kind of bomb, but they had also developed long-range aircraft that would still be able to reach the United States via an Arctic route. Since the U.S. had no real defense against a nuclear attack, I think it's safe to say that there was a little bit of panic and a whole bunch of people needed to do a lot of problem solving really quickly. Looking into this further, it looks like the Ground Control of Intercept, or GCI radar network that was developed during World War II, had really only been designed to defend against an attack with conventional weapons, and it really only had a limited ability to detect incoming hostile aircraft. At this point, an associate professor from the MIT physics department named George Valley decided to try to tackle the problem. After a bunch of troubleshooting and like a good IT department, Valley and his committee determined that they needed a way to transmit radar data to a central computer where the data could be aggregated, and then the computer had to be able to analyze the data in real time and transmit it so that it could be used for defensive purposes. Long story short, this realization then led to the development of a digital radar relay that was capable of converting analog radar signals into digital code that could then be transmitted over telephone lines. Plus, there was also the development of the world's first real-time computer that was fast enough to handle all of the real-time data analysis. Skipping a lot more steps in that story for the sake of time, It also led to the creation of the SAGE air defense system that allowed operators to plot both friendly and enemy aircraft locations on a map using a series of inputs, which seems like a huge upgrade considering that prior to that, operators had to manually plot vector locations, update a map, and then relay the information to pilots. That sounds like an absolute pain, and something needed to be done about it, and it looks like they were making progress with the SAGE air defense system. So thinking about this in terms of the art world, how does this relate? Well, the displays for the maps and radars use vector graphics to visually show data using a vector cathode ray tube display, which is like a TV that display dots to show positions, since these vector display devices could define a line using that series of X and Y data points that were super easy to transmit. These devices were revolutionary for displaying and transmitting information until they were retired from the U.S. military and replaced with air traffic control technology in 1999. That quick little history lesson there was actually pretty cool and is something I totally was definitely not expecting to stumble across when researching for this episode. I think I got all that information correct and summarized it okay based on the novel-length article that I was reading. But yeah, that was the first time that vector graphic displays started to come into the world. And for clarification, again, the article was mostly talking about the displays for vector graphics and how those were developed rather than actual things like the vector files that designers use today. But it's still an interesting milestone in the development of vector graphics that I figured might be interesting to some listeners. Turning more towards graphics, files, the art world, and things like that, vector art can be traced back to a man named Ivan Edward Sutherland, who developed the graphics software Sketchpad that introduced the idea that computer graphics could serve a dual purpose for technical and artistic applications. In the beginning, vector graphics were super simple, and they were still really limited to relatively straight lines. So where did the curves come from? Because things aren't super angular and all straight edges. Well, that is all thanks to a French engineer named Pierre Bézier, which now totally makes sense why those curves are called Bézier curves, because this guy was able to figure out how to mathematically proportionally scale curved lines. When he was working on designing bodywork for Renault cars, which is a more European brand that hasn't really broken into the US market too much, but while he was working on the design for a new car model, he stumbled upon the basis for what would become scalable digital image vector graphics, and that ultimately became one of the foundational elements of today's digital graphic design. Because of his work, we can now create really precise and clean lines using those Bézier curves that use those handles we talked about earlier as control points for the curved lines. These points then tie to a mathematical equation that forces all points to maintain proportion as the size changes. And that's what allows vectors to be perfectly and infinitely scalable to this day. Somehow in my research, I also found a website that talks about the mathematics behind vector graphics. And it really went over my head, but I'm going to include that in the show notes just in case you want to take a look at it and be as thoroughly stumped as I am. Because it's one thing for me to tell you that it's based on math, but I guess this website somehow proves it through putting numbers there that I'm hoping actually mean something and I'm not just getting duped. But moving on through the history of vector graphics. This is where we get into the next stage in vector graphic evolution. And I'm going to say I definitely wasn't as surprised when my research confirmed that some of the first more widely used instances of vector graphics come in the form of video games. If we think about it, just like the smaller file sizes let the big clunky computers of the 50s do things a little bit better, the small file sizes of vector graphics also allowed for some advancements in video games. One of the video game consoles that I stumbled upon repeatedly when looking this up was a video game console that was quite aptly named Vectrex, that exclusively used vector graphics to display graphics. It was a home video game console released in North America in 1982, and it was super unique because you didn't need to hook it up to a television to play. And that's because it had an integrated black and white cathode ray tube monitor with a detachable wired control pad that could be stored in the lower base of the monitor. And if that isn't crazy enough, the games came with translucent color overlays to place over the screen that gave the perception of changing the game's color. The console itself worked by drawing a constant stream of images across the X and Y axis that updated in real time in response to the user's input from that wired controller. Even though some people considered it one of the best video game systems of the time, it was a victim of what we call the video game crash of 1983. That was caused by a huge oversaturation in the video game market because of all the new video games and consoles that were out there. And to add in a fun fact, the color display handheld version of the Vectrex was shelved because of not only the manufacturing cost, but what really did it in was the success of the Nintendo Game Boy, which I'm sure a lot of us, even here in 2023, can still remember all of the fantastic times of playing Pokemon or Tetris on a Nintendo Game Boy.
Despite the Vectrex disappearing from the gaming market, the use of vector graphics didn't disappear entirely. If you're old enough to remember arcade games like Atari's Asteroids in the 70s, Space Wars and Tempest, or if you go to barcades like 16-bit, then yes, some of those games use vector graphics too. And I want to apologize real quick because that same audio issue is happening where all of a sudden the microphone just decides to pick up on all of the lower tones. So I apologize for that audio quality shifting, but we're just going to keep going. If we then look at computer and software development companies like Apple, Microsoft, and even Xerox, computers themselves didn't necessarily require vector graphics to run, but the advancement in this technology paved the way for personal computers to be introduced into homes and made graphic design tasks more accessible to everyone. And with advances in personal computing accessibility, there also came tools to utilize graphic design for technical and artistic endeavors. Adobe began development of Adobe Illustrator in 1985, and I would argue that Illustrator is one of, if not the leading vector graphics software in the entire industry. And that was released to the public 36 years ago, all the way back in 1987. I do have an entire History of Adobe episode on the to-do list for future Artrageous episodes, so I won't go into all of that too much, but basically, while the first version of Photoshop was released after Illustrator in 1990, Photoshop was primarily geared towards digital photo manipulation, and Illustrator provided solutions for typesetting and logo graphics. Fast forward to 1999, and that's when the World Wide Web Consortium adopted the standard SVG file format for vector graphics. SVG stands for Scalable Vector Graphic, and that is absolutely perfect for modern web design because that file type not only maintains the scalable proportions of the graphic, but it also includes text features for indexing and searchability. Plus, the file can be modified without any specific vector graphic software. So what I mean is if you have a file with a .ai extension, you pretty much have to use Adobe Illustrator to edit the file. But SVG files can be read by pretty much every vector graphics software that's out there. If your vector graphics software can't handle that, then you might have the world's most useless vector graphics software around. So now that we've talked about how and why vector graphics exist, I know we talked about it a little bit before, but I thought of some other things vector graphics are used for. I already mentioned the pros of scalability and the benefits for a responsive app and web design that adapts to different screen sizes, whether you're looking at that web page on a phone, a tablet, or a computer. So I'll skip over that bullet point since I jumped the gun there, but I did not yet talk about uses in animation and CAD design. Animation is pretty simple. Back in the day, thinking about the early Disney movies, everything was drawn by hand, frame by frame, and then photographed. Nowadays, a vast majority of 2D movies and cartoons are animated using digital animation that relies on vector graphics to create everything from the characters to the backgrounds, the props, you name it. The reason for this is A, it's a lot easier to animate a vector-based character than to hand-draw animations. Copy and paste alone is such a huge efficiency. Reason B is if you watch a 2D animated thing, the characters are not always the same size. I wasn't an animation major, so animation people, please don't scream if I'm off a bit here. But in the simplest animations, the animators have a character design that they can copy and paste into scenes, and then they make that character bigger or smaller depending on the scene they're putting them in. Sometimes the character's face takes up the whole screen and the character needs to be scaled up really, really big. Other times the character is in a crowd of other characters, so the characters are smaller and have to be scaled down. By using vector graphics, animators can scale that character up and down and left and right as many times as they want, and that line quality and resolution will never change. Overall, using vector graphics in animation, like in other applications, provides for cleaner and smoother images. I mentioned in another episode that design exists in the world in places outside of graphic design and fine artists, like with people who are industrial designers. Industrial designers also use vector graphics when they use computer-aided design, or CAD tools. CAD programs frequently use vector files for design, manufacturing, and engineering because of the level of high geometric precision that vector files provide. Since each point of the design has a mathematical data set connected to it, that really helps out with things that require a super high level of precision, like machining and manufacturing. Thinking about how easy it is for vector programs to edit the mathematical formulas when scaling, in theory, if a schematic for something like the blueprints for a house are created using a CAD software that uses vector graphics, then the blueprints for the house could be scaled up and printed on super big paper that the construction crew then uses on site, and those images won't be blurry even at that enlarged size because vector graphics save the day. Which reminds me of a fun fact that I found, that a standard PDF file is actually considered a vector file type, even if it does include inserted JPEG and PNG images. I could probably sit here and name these different applications for vector graphics all day. Comics, graphic novels, GIF animations, cover art for books and music, building signage, business cards, social media graphics and assets, advertising campaigns, brand illustrations, t-shirt designs, fonts, infographics, mobile apps, embroidery, PowerPoint presentations. The list literally goes on and on, and I think that really shows how versatile vector graphics have become and how deeply ingrained they are in modern design. Really fantastic and great examples of vector art can be found absolutely everywhere. I always hesitate to call out specific artists in situations like these because there's just so many fantastic artists out there, so I won't do that here, but there are artists who really, really push the boundaries of vector art. There are some artists that create these absolutely amazing illustrations that are just so dynamic and filled with color and just push the boundaries of everything that I think about vector art. And I know I said earlier that vector art isn't a real good substitution for photos, but looking at some artists' works makes me question my own statement with how they push those boundaries. So in summary, vector graphics are pretty cool. So cool, in fact, that I have just spent the entire podcast episode talking about it and have probably gone longer than I originally anticipated. But at the end of the day, if you're a beginning artist or a designer that hasn't used vector graphics as much, I highly encourage you to start looking at them. The pen tool in Adobe Illustrator is a bit weird and awkward to master at first, and it may make you want to throw your computer. At least that's what it did for me, but just keep trying because it gets easier and it is actually kind of fun once you figure it out. If you're a more established and professional creative listening in, I'm sorry if I went into things that you already knew, but hopefully there were some fun tidbits in this episode that kept you at least mildly entertained. And if you aren't an artist or designer, I also hope you found something fun and interesting that might be a good conversation starter at some point. And as always, thank you everyone for tuning into another episode of Artrageous. I had a lot of fun researching this episode and hopefully didn't blabber on too much, but here's your quick, somewhat weekly reminder to rate the show in your podcast app because that really does help me out. I will be back next week with another episode. I apologize again for the weird audio situation in this back half of the episode. I thought I figured it out, but apparently not. And so along with looking at content for next week's episode, I will also be trying to troubleshoot this microphone audio issue. Maybe it'll go away. Maybe it'll come back and join us next week. Who knows? But until then, stay outrageous.
Series music created by Arensen. Music and transition sounds licensed from Motion Array. Outrageous is a proud partner of Stoveleg Media.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.